Well, good morning, everyone. So the idea of the panel is to discuss private placements of reinsurance. The market obviously has been extremely attractive, especially over the last 3 years. But there's been a lot of discussion about liquidity, and that's exactly what Steve just mentioned, and the fact that we've seen way more inflows for catastrophe bonds than private placements of reinsurance. Now, despite us thinking that that market is still liquid enough, usually funds have quarterly liquidity or semi-annual liquidity, the main inflows have gone into the catastrophe bond market. Now, recently I spoke to investors and an investor, and he said, "But how come we are not able to raise more money in the industry?" And they said, "Oh, it's simple. You call all your investment catastrophe risk. You should just call them reassurance risk." And I said, "Okay, reassurance bonds or reassurance private placement of reinsurance." So, Steve, if you can start, adding that to your chart for next year, that would be great. Now, just to set the scene, obviously, this has been the, we are entering the third year of hard market. And, going back in, and this is for those that are relatively new to the asset class, and I know there are two or three investors that are here for the first time. So in our asset class for private placements and also traditional reinsurance tend to roll over these deals every year at a certain date. Key dates are 1st of January and 1st of June, 1st of July. That's when around 40 to 50% of our portfolios roll over. Now, in January 2023, the market basically witnessed disjoint and challenging renewals with rebalancing required from most of the insurance companies. We had very high rate increases, capacity crunch, and market conditions were also affected from the volatility due to the geopolitical and macroeconomic shocks, including high inflation and the interest rate hikes. Then, January 2024, we had more stable renewals. So it was more predictable, there was more capacity. It was a great year for returns and performance in 2023. Finally, investors were extremely pleased with the returns that we were able to deliver. And this resulted in a flat risk-adjusted premium at renewals with a very positive market sentiment. And then most recently, 1st of January renewals, 2025, again, orderly renewals. Main negotiation points were focused on price, with retention levels from insurance companies maintained at a very high level, which also helped the performance for fundamentals. In terms of premiums, according to Guy Carpenter, it went down roughly on average by 6 to 7%. Now, as we enter this new year, however, we're all aware about the losses and the wildfires that unfortunately occurred in Los Angeles. Now, this is, in my opinion, a pivotal event, and the estimate for the industry losses are around, again, there are different opinions. I mean, the range is between 30, we even heard 50 billion, I think, at Ledenor, at the moment, we are at around 40 billion without counting for potential subrogation. So, in our opinion, the market is again hardening. These events have already, the estimate is they've already eroded around 35 to 40% of the reinsurance cut budget of the insurers. And we expect probably a mid-year renewals to be attractive from a premium standpoint, at least to stay stable, if not increase again. So having said that, I'm very pleased to have here, my colleagues. I've been told not to introduce them because you're supposed to read their bio on the brochure. So, I'm not being rude here. So maybe let's start with George. This market obviously has delivered very strong performance over the last 2 years across the sector. So what do you think are the factors that have contributed to the success, but most importantly, the investor sentiment for the asset class?
Yeah, sure. So I see a lot of familiar faces in here, but I also see a lot of people that I don't know. So I know we're not supposed to introduce ourselves, but I will anyway. My name's George. I work at XCR. It's a global panels consulting group. I'm one of four who co-lead the Hetron research process there. That's about 30 individual analysts, two of whom spend a large majority of their time looking at ILS. But in general, we're building kind of diversified, balanced hedge fund portfolios, and ILS is included as part of that. As a side note, we also look at ILS through our venture capital business, and we look at ILS through our private credit business, more on the life and annuity side of things. So the way I talk about our investor base, it's very institutional, US state pensions, Middle Eastern sovereigns, Asian insurance. And just collectively, I'd say there was a 2017-2018 cohort that stepped in size into the ILS market that have more or less been absent for the last 3 or 4 years. It was a tough experience for that cohort of investors. And then we had a new cohort of investors that stepped in Q4 22. The sentiment amongst that new cohort of investors is very, very strong. They've obviously had a very positive experience in the last 2 years. The majority of that money did go into the cap bond market purely because the return targets on the portfolios that we build are relatively conservative. And with cap bonds offering a 15 to 20 all-in return, no loss, that's multiples of what a lot of our clients are targeting, you know, year over year as an annualized IRR target. So the majority have been in cap bonds. They've had a very positive experience, and we've started those conversations now around what's next, what else exists in the market. And these are people that haven't spent a lot of time in ILS, and where education is really the key lever to kind of solidify that experience and have them provide an increasing amount of support capital-wise to the industry. The most interesting shift in sentiment, I would say, in the last few weeks, I would say, it's very fresh, is that 2017 to 2018 cohort have come back to the market. The holdup for those in 22 was a lot of board involvement, a lot of investment committee involvement just in the prior experience, and now there's 2 years of positive performance behind their renewed pitch to the board and their renewed arguments to why ILS deserves a structural place in portfolios is supported now by 2 years of positive experience. I would say those are the investors that have been involved in the space for many, many years and understand everything from the cap on market to rated balance sheets to sidecars to quota shares. And so if that cohort does come back, which it looks likely they will, again, it should be a huge support to the broader ILS community rather than just the risk remote side of things.
Aditya?
Yeah, good morning, everyone. Great to be here. I think George captured it really well. Our experience has been that we did lose a fair bit of the investor base collectively as an industry between the years 17 and 23. For various reasons, some good, some not so good. In the last 2 years, there has been a resurgence in interest, possibly driven by good returns, which always help. But I think also the fundamental strengths of the asset class, which is the non-correlating nature, good risk-adjusted returns, and a very, very significant improvement in the market. Whether it's price or terms and conditions. So we're an institutional shop, and we see primarily interest from institutional investors. But I agree with George. I think a lot of the investors that either left the market or looked at it seriously in the last 5 or 6 years have now taken the plunge. So I think as a point in time matter, we're in good shape, but actually also, as George mentioned, events like the fire in California, and I would categorize it very broadly as surprises are what's what keeps people away. And you know, we have an investor on the panel. I'd love to hear Evelyn's point of view on it, but I think that's the one thing that we as an industry have to be very aware of and try to control over time is this ability to surprise or negative ability to surprise, rather. But overall, I think George hit the nail on the head. It's the interest is certainly at a level that is much, much higher than it used to be 5 or 6 years ago.
Okay, thank you. As you mentioned, Evelyn, so Evelyn, what factors have influenced your success in this asset class? Because when you look at, also when we look at your track record, you've done very well, so for the volatility that we suffered in 2017. So it would be good to get an overview of how you position your portfolio over time and what are the challenges that you've been facing.
Okay, well, thank you also for having me. So it's true, we have been in the asset class since 2006. We started with cat bonds, added collateralized reinsurance managers, ILS fund managers, added quota shares, rated vehicles, and we even set up a managed account platform called Nightingale Re. I think overall, being such a long player or investor in the asset class, you come across soft market, you come across things that you thought you did well, but then there's events happening, and sometimes you realize that what you thought you did well, actually you did not do well. But as long as it was part of, we never encountered a major issue. So we had a quota share, for example, in 2015, not a very active cat event. We ended it after a year, and we had some trapped collateral. Not a lot, but still, I think it led to learnings that we then adjusted our legal documentation. So in case when we had the 17, 18, 19 losses, our trapped collateral was not as pronounced as maybe other investors had. On top of that, we tried to also, I would say, hide a little bit more from the secondary perils, or to be concluded whether we were successful with it after the wildfire event. But typically, our risk profile is slightly more remote compared to the industry. And that, I do believe, that helped us during the years of 2017-18. But also, it didn't lead to returns of 50% in 2023 and 24. So I'd say slightly more moderate.
Actually, you touched a very interesting point, because every asset class does suffer volatility, right? And we all learn from lessons. And the collateral trapping issues that we faced back in 2017 and 18 have been discussed at length, from the market, and try to see how to make the investors' money work in the most efficient way going forward, right? Because ultimately we need to make sure that any collateral trap doesn't cause a drag on the return of the investor. And probably the message to the investor is, well, we have evolved, okay? And there are solutions there. Of course, there is still a developing period post-event. It's going to take a while to know exactly what will be the ultimate loss, of the contract. But having said that, there are now techniques that help to mitigate the drag on your return. And so, Mark, what is, in your opinion, what has evolved in the market in terms of how the investors' sentiment has evolved, and given your experience?
Yeah. No. Thanks. Thanks to Artemis and Steve for the opportunity. It's interesting, the word cloud that Steve showed with price very much at the foundation of that cloud. I think returns matter in the industry. It feels finally like we're at a sustainable level now in 2025. This appropriate return, given the volatility of the asset class, this consideration for the illiquidity of the risk profile, it does feel good what we have in front of us for 2025, but there's never a shortage of surprises. We've seen that already in the first few weeks of 2025. I do feel the industry constantly does learn as we go along. There's a lot of brain power in this room, thinking about how the industry as a whole can continue to improve. And we're not afraid of making those adjustments as we go forward. Certainly terms and conditions improved. We feel that the product did move back more to a volatility product, back in the tail risk part of the spectrum, protecting volatility, priced for volatility. That had slipped over the course of, the soft cycle. It's in a good place moving forward. And that was largely through the reset of 2023. 2024, as you mentioned before, remained strong from a return perspective. We have a year of account that as you mentioned, renews mid-year in 2025. So we still have contracts on risk that came out of that strong pricing cycle. I think the jury's still out a little bit on 2024. We sell volatility products, but also a lot of aggregate products. So to the extent that we have some European wind to run, a bit of winter storm, there's all of these other secondary perils that exist that we need to continue to think about before we can say 2024 really solidified the stability of the market. But I otherwise echo. You know what folks are saying here on the panel.
You actually made a good point in terms of reminding our audience about the level of industry losses that the industry suffered, right? So around 2023, I think the estimate was just over $100 billion. So last year, we're talking about $140 billion estimate. And despite those levels of industry losses, we've been able to deliver very strong performances. And now the talk is that the new average is mm-hmm. going to be 140 to 150 billion per annum because of this frequency of the secondary perils. And so this is also to put into context that going back probably 7-8 years, the industry average was more about 70 to 80 billion. So we are approaching almost the double size of industry losses, but we are, as an industry, we have evolved and we're doing very well to still try.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with you. I think that's right. I think if we look at price increase as a single metric, it can look like, in the market reset, that was a big increase, but there's an associated risk landscape that's increased with that. I think if you look at the time span from sort of 2016 through to 2020 as a five-year average and then a new five-year average, in the last 5 years, our average annual industry loss has actually kept pace with that increase in price. So it is a riskier world, as we well know. And no shortage of surprises that we need to consider as we price the business.
Aditya, George made a point about what level of interest he had from his investors in the carbon market, right? However, we've seen that recently the pricing has been decoupling between private placements and carbons because of the inflows that we saw. So what's your opinion in terms of the price differential now, bearing in mind that carbons remain still very attractive, right? Versus traditional asset classes like corporate high yield and so on. However, this pricing differential now is really more evident.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent observation. The we're much larger in the not cat bond space, although we have a presence in bonds. My observation of the bond market is that the spreads have been contracting over the past 6 months. I don't think that will surprise anyone in this room. And arguably, they've contracted more than riskier parts of the loss tower, right? So if you, just a very simplistic example, if you're higher rate online and higher risk, I think that capacity is harder to find in the reinsurance market and the retro market. Whereas because of the inflows in the cat bond world, it seems, and the returns, more consistent returns, arguably, over time, that actually pricing that's available to a cedent or to a sponsor in the bond market is relatively more attractive. And I think I forget who published a chart very recently, but almost all of the recent deals have upsized and priced at the bottom end of the guidance. And again, I'm not an expert at this. I'm sitting in front of John So, so watch what I say. But
you're right.
But I think that relativity between the top of the tower and the bottom of the tower is diverging a little bit. It's not moving lockstep. That's probably my simplistic observation. And we play sizably at more at the riskier levels, and we find that capacity is tougher to find, tougher to structure, and tougher for cedents to source. But that would be my observation.
And Evelyn, obviously you've been investing across all spectrum, still just in property cat, but all spectrum, right? So what's your view in terms of the relative value play and how do you use that within PGGM?
Yeah, well, we aim for efficient structures. I think that's so we have given a risk profile and we try to adhere to that risk profile. It's not that we play cat bonds vis-a-vis more junior tranches. We don't see the relativity. We believe that we are strategic, long-term. We aim for a certain risk. We have a preference for risk. We have the ability to shift up and down. So ideally, in a hard market, you would be slightly larger, slightly more riskier, and vice versa. In a soft market, you would maybe reduce the allocation ideally and have slightly less risk. But overall, I think for us, the answer is we aim for a product where we be efficient as possible, try to have low cost, some operational leverage as part of that, because I think that's the element that cat bonds do not offer. I think from cat bonds, it's full collateral, even if just going to collateralized reinsurance typically is limit minus premium. You can add further leverage by doing quota share. So I think that helps generating returns over the cycle.
And just to clarify, Evelyn is referring to underwriting leverage rather than debt leverage, which you know sometimes investors get confused. But basically, it's how do you make sure that you get as close as possible to the model of a reinsurance company in terms of, each reinsurers would have a level of capital which is way lower than the total exposures that they have. And so similarly now, as investors, we are able to post a part of the collateral rather than collateralize the full limit, which obviously enhance the potential yield that you get in our market.
But maybe to add, I think also it's not that we don't value bonds. I think we also have a very sizable bond portfolio. I think there's a cleanness to it, which maybe is less pronounced in the other instruments that are out there. So for us, it's just the overall combination.
Sorry, George, you have
it. Yeah, I was just going to say, when you're looking at the risk layers on a relative basis, like there's a lot more development and improvement that has been made on the higher risk end of the stack with respect to dealing with trap collateral and the like. And so I think what the last couple of years has proven is that even at the higher end of the spectrum, there's now enough premium available there and attachment points are high enough that even with the uncertainty that Didier mentioned, you can deal with that uncertainty because there's been proof that the asset class at the higher risk end of the spectrum has been able to withstand a couple of very, very major events. And while investors do their best to try to understand the climatology, the modeling, the underwriting, at the end of the day, there's nothing more powerful than the asset class going through a period, having the events, giving a good return experience. And I think the other thing that's probably a little understated, trap collateral is a bad word. Nobody likes to have trap collateral, but no one talks about the treasury yield nowadays. I think the issue in 17, 18, 19 is trap collateral was a real drag on portfolios because it was large and you were getting a zero treasury yield on that collateral. Now, although investors prefer not to have it, if it's in their portfolio, at least they're getting something for it, which I think that's if we see investors go from the more risk remote end of the stack, which is where we reside, I think there are certain things that make the high risk end of the spectrum relatively more attractive today than it was maybe 4 or 5 years ago.
Aditya, do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, no. Unsurprisingly, people talk about trap collateral a lot in our business, and fairly so. I think I can point to a couple of things that have made very significant changes in or improvements in trap collateral. One, obviously price helps, but movement and attachment point is a huge help to trapping in the collateralized world, at least. Changing buffers, buffer loss factors, which has occurred very, very significantly in the last couple of years, is a huge deal that you can bring down the amount of trap capital faster in a reinsurance contract post-event. And then, as George mentioned, the yield that you're receiving. All that said, I think the totality of all the terms and conditions that have changed in reinsurance contracts all help trap collateral, every single one of them. When you cut perils, when you move attachment points, when you cut buffer loss, change buffer loss tables, have forced commutation provisions in reinsurance contracts that allow the reinsurer to force commute after a certain amount of time, these are all incredibly helpful. And I think one of the bright spots of the industry is that we've improved how we handle trap collateral. Unfortunately, the lower down the risk tower you go, the more this is a relevant, germane topic. But I think all of these changes have improved. And maybe there's some way to go additionally. And then I look at what firms like NSTAR have done, provide solutions to funds out there, and what Markel has done with Nephila. All of this is excellent. It may not be perfect, but I think all of it is excellent.
Yeah. And probably it's also worth reminding that the issue of trap collateral applied to both catastrophe bonds and private placements of reinsurance, right? Which is very important. So if you invest in a catastrophe bond that has a tenor, let's say, of 3 years, and there is an event just before the end of the maturity, then the bond gets extended for maybe 3 years. And it start trading well below par, right? So again, that's collateral trapping risk. So, it's the equivalent of a private placement of reinsurance. Now, moving on, and thinking about the macro environment, right? And this is for George. So, obviously, we only deal with insurance risk, at least at Lebanon, but others deal with other type of assets. But what are the factors that can influence the attractiveness of ILS, in investors, given what else is going on in the world between interest rates, inflation, and so on?
Yeah. So if you split it into two and you think about ILS in isolation, I think we've kind of covered that side of things. And then you look at ILS relative to every other asset class that one of our clients can invest in. Like I said, we have private credit, venture, hedge fund portfolios, even within themselves where ILS live. There's competition for capital from multi-strat, levered speculators, equity funds, and on a relative basis, the consistency of the return that ILS provides is very attractive, in the last couple of years for certain. And the diversification benefit, we don't really need to debate it for that long, that whether risk is not correlated to credit risk or equity risk. So, from a portfolio construction process, now that ILS is at a place where, there's enough premium in the system and terms and conditions have improved, that diversification benefit is extremely attractive to a large majority of our hedge fund client portfolios. So, again, I won't redo the absolute return argument for ILS because we've covered that, but on a relative basis versus other hedge funds and the diversification benefit it brings to portfolios is the primary driver. People want to invest in ILS because of the diversification. The one thing I would say that is a little bit of a hold up, and again, I think Aditya and I have had many conversations about this, is the educational side of things. Your average US state pension fund that we advise doesn't necessarily have a dedicated ILS professional on staff. And so that's where we step in with ILS professionals to try to advise them on why this is an asset class they should invest in.
Evelyn, obviously you have to champion and push ILS internally and discuss with your investment committee. So what are the challenges that you face or the questions that you more often get every time you try maybe to slightly increase the allocation to ILS within GGM?
Well, there's two main concern from that perspective, if you look at it that way. I think still even though we had two great years from a return perspective, I think relative to other returning asset categories, it's on a 10-year basis, it's not outperforming. So if you think about private equity, infrastructure investments, but even public equity, I think at least for our insurance portfolio generated a decent return, but it's definitely not. I think we are we have a long-term return expectation, and currently we're near or at that long-term return expectation, including those two very great years. So I think we need to remain sharp as an industry, and also not say, well, okay, we've had two good years, let it go. I think it's important for that to continue. Also because we have not seen, even though we've had a large event, we didn't see a major event. So that's one thing that could potentially prevent us to even have a larger allocation, as we're still part of a return portfolio and we are funded from an equity portfolio. The other consideration that we hear internally is there's an easily made link between climate change and ILS. And I think that is something that we need to address as an industry. So also with the wildfires, people immediately say, oh, that's because of climate change. And I think to a certain extent, that might be true. But I think there's also other contributing factors. And we need to be very clear and kind of educate what part is related to climate change and what parts are related to, well, first of all, exposure, growth, inflation, but also to kind of human elements when it comes to the wildfires, for example. I think we have some educational, and we need to educate investors, and also we need to further educate our boards for them to have a good understanding.
Okay, so we have two angles here, right? So first is ILS versus other asset classes. You mentioned private equity and infrastructure as outperforming ILS, right? But obviously that is the different level of liquidity. Is that something that you guys take into account when you discuss that or not?
Well, we look at return from, we're pension plans for typically long term, so we look at it from a 3, 5, 10 year perspective. So from a 3 year perspective, we've done really well, and I'm also very pleased with that. I'm just saying we need to keep it up. I think also we've had 6 years from 2017 till 2022 where there was not that much of a return. So just depending on what horizon you look at it, it looks great or it looks just at target.
I would actually just add on that point, one thing that I failed to mention was, you know, I couldn't agree with Evelyn more in terms of trying to obtain structural efficiencies in the way that you access the asset class. The problem we've bumped into with that is that requires a longer duration of capital than your traditional collateralized reinsurance vehicle. And for a firm like us, that kind of shuffles things around, and the competition for capital is no longer with a hedge fund portfolio, it's with our private credit business. And for many years prior to 2022, rated balance sheets are a very efficient way of accessing the asset class, helps get over the trap collateral, gives you a little bit of leverage. But the mean expected return relative to private credit, which is the fastest growing area of our business, you know, anything Lloyd related, anything rated balance sheet related, you know, was kind of X diversification benefits losing the beauty contest with what we were seeing on the private credit side. That's definitely shifted. And so now even some of the clients that we have that have longer duration capital have started to look at the diversification benefits, and the mean expected return is kind of adjusted to be equivalent to that of some of their large private credit holdings. So I just figured that was worth mentioning because Evelyn's mentioned, you know, rated balance sheets and structuring and things like that. I think that's a critical piece of where the next leg higher comes from our client base in terms of the allocation.
And then Evelyn, you mentioned, you know, climate change and wildfires, which obviously is very, you know, topical. Maybe I'll ask Mark, you know, to comment on you know, what are the challenges from a, you know, modeling standpoint, and then pass it to Aditya maybe also to comment on that. Before I get Evelyn on fire.
Yeah, it's certainly a hot topic and the elephant in the room. Before I get there, maybe just to say, I think it's important to recognize that our capital does compete. I think we forget that sometimes. I think we get so caught up in the nuance of our business and focused on, you know, the production side, putting that capital at work. You know, we forget about, you know, the opportunity costs that investors are taking to bring that capital into this marketplace. I think, you know, one risk is arguably, you know, a premature softening. You know, we're at a stage now where we're over the return hurdle. We have a little bit of time, I think, to be transparent with investors, to help educate, you know, while you have a bit of a buffer of premium in the system. It also feels a little bit like, you know, prior experience feels less of a predictor of future performance. You know, there are uncertain things that keep coming out, you know, in our market. Do the models capture those efficiently so that we, you know, we feel that we've priced things correctly? I think, you know, every couple of years it feels like we've missed something, or we're a little outdated or a little bit behind the curve. We're missing a data layer that would really help us understand what that risk landscape is. So no shortage of work to do there, I think, from a modeling standpoint. But we have to be careful, I think, that we don't follow those models too carefully. Good old-fashioned underwriting and understanding your client is certainly important. The models can help you fill in some missing gaps. But you know, there's always more data that you can bring. You know, particularly in this world of big data, you know, innovation showed up on that that word. I love that word map. So I think there's lots of innovation and work to do to, again, build investor confidence and prove that we really understand what's happening and how climate risk is really impacting the product that we sell.
Aditya, what is your view on that?
We're talking about the fire specifically.
It's up to you.
Might as well.
I was waiting for Evelyn then to start asking all the questions about the fires, but please go ahead.
No problem. Okay, so I think there's a couple of angles to look at the fire in California. Number one, this is, you know, if it's a $50 billion event or even a $40 billion event, we're talking about a top five, top six event in the last 50 years to impact the United States, the global reinsurance market. You know, there's 9/11's bigger, Tohoku's bigger, Katrina's bigger, but not many more. So this is a major, major event. And if you think back to any of the events I just mentioned and compared it to the reaction to this fire, you would say that was a watershed moment. California is not a watershed moment. I don't think so. It doesn't seem like it today. So I would say that's kind of angle number one, that we're talking about a top five event in 50 years insured loss-wise, and we're not talking about a depletion of capital to this industry. We're not worried about the capital position of the industry. There's no panic. In general, there's a pretty good understanding of how this loss comes into reinsurance layers, how it works with the FAIR plan, how it goes into retro deals. There's a decent understanding. And so I think let's call it what it is, $50 billion event and no panic. I think that's pretty remarkable. Second, if you think about what is the reinsurance industry designed to do, that we should be selling a product that protects solvency at the appropriate price. And you know, if there's a general category of feedback I can put the investor, all that we've heard from investors, I would say you were selling a earnings protection product at a solvency price. Don't do that anymore, please. You know, sell the right product. I think it would be hard to argue that a $50 billion wildfire should go unprotected by the reinsurance industry as a matter of principle. You know, if we as an industry can't respond to things like this, I think it's fair for a customer to say, you know, what is it that you do precisely? And so okay, I think the modeling point is a fair one. Everyone on this stage certainly and others would say, hey, here's my view of risk in wildfire and et cetera. But I think this should not be a surprise event. This should be in the modeled distribution. It should be $50 billion fires, which are 3 to 4x the worst fire ever, are covered perils in the reinsurance business. And I think it's a fair criticism to say the models may not be perfect on this. I think that's very fair feedback. I think it's fair to say that certain secondary perils should have been excluded. And they are from many treaties. But I think taking a step back and saying the fifth largest event in 50 years will not damage the industry irreparably and cause a fundamental restructuring, I think is a pretty remarkable outcome.
Interesting. So the, you know, you reckon that this loss will be easily absorbed, right? And the definition of secondary peril usually is like it's an event that should cause an earning issue for the insurance companies rather than a capital issue, right? However, you know, do you expect any of the local homeowners, or, you know, obviously there are rumors about State Farm and their rating and so on. I mean, what do you expect the implication will be from a solvency standpoint?
So, won't comment by name, but I'm not sure the reinsurance industry is going to have a negative year this year. We've got 11 months to go.
Not default.
There's a lot of risk period left in the year. So
none of the local homeowners will default, in your opinion?
I don't think so. There may be one or two, but this is not. This is not a default event necessarily for a global or a nationwide company. I think far from it. They're really well capitalized. The other thing is the reinsurance industry, you know, let's call it $40 billion. Let's split it two-thirds, one-third, personal lines versus reinsurance, just argument's sake. That's not a fact. Even do it 50-50, that's a $20 billion loss for an industry that has $600 billion of capital. Again, I'm not sure why this would be groundbreaking in any sense. Compare this to 9/11, which at the time was probably a $28 billion ultimate loss against industry capital of $220 billion odd. Okay, that's a big deal. That's just not where we are. So I'll take the argument from people that it's a big deal, but please present the data.
My question is not about whether it was a large event, because it was a large event. The question is whether investors were aware that this risk was so large or could be leading to such a large loss in their portfolio, given that it's typically sold as a secondary event. And if you look at contribution to EL, clearly it's there. But you can question whether everyone has the same thought about what a large loss would be from a secondary event.
Yeah, but I think every manager has dealt with secondary perils in different ways, right? I mean, we have, you know, in our case, we've been shying away from secondary perils, so our exposure is quite limited. And then you have, you know, everyone has their own views on diversification, accumulation of risk, whether you pay enough or not for the risk that you take, whether you believe that your models are right, whether you want to add factor loadings. But you made a point about transparency, right, Evelyn? So, you know, what do you expect more?
I think it has improved already, and we're going into the right direction. But I think we cannot stop it. I think more is better. I think the negative surprises that we've had, those are causing disruption. Ultimately, the question: what was it causing the private ALS side to not grow maybe as fast as cat bonds? Well, that's negative surprises.
Okay. Now let's talk about pricing, because I think at the end of the day, you know, investors want to hear that, obviously we discuss about tight terms and conditions, you know, retention being higher. However, the first question we always get is where are we in the cycle, right? And earlier I mentioned that the latest renewals, we had this slight decrease of, you know, 6-7 according to Guy Carpenter, rate online index. However, we have this event that has just occurred that is very severe. And it's going to dent the profitability of a lot of insurance companies and also insurers. So what's your view on pricing? Maybe I start with you, Evelyn, and then Mark, Aditya, and...
I hope it will go up again. I want is that the industry remains sharp. Okay. I think that's what I think. Retention's critical.
Yeah.
Maintain adequate retention going forward. So not just keep it for now for a couple of numbers of years, just continue to adjust with inflation and exposure growth. But other than that, ideally, I hope that also the trend of climate change will be part of the risk assessment and pricing going forward, so that we're stop looking backward, but take events into account that we haven't seen yet. That would be great.
Mark?
Investors care about price, clearly. That brings capital into the system. I don't think any of us would like to see volatility in price. It's a volatile enough world and product that we sell. So the more stable we can keep price, I think that's creates a more sustainable product, sustainable marketplace, and keeps investors interested. I think that's...
Yeah, Aditya.
So I think just to get into the nuts and bolts of it, we've got two major renewals coming up, Japan and the mid-year renewal, which is both nationwide and Atlantic hurricane-focused. I'm not sure we'll see a ton of price discovery as a result of this event in those two renewals. That's just my opinion. That said, California, let's assume this is the only event for a little bit of time, is going to affect such a broad cross-section of the market, from personal lines to reinsurance to retro, that it's hard to see how this doesn't factor into 1/1/26. I think is the real discovery, price discovery, and I don't know what the price will be. If anyone does, please let us know. But I don't know what it'll be. But I think to real price discovery on California, and the cross section of the industry that this event is going to impact, will be known better at 1/1/26 than it will be at April or June. And there are actually a lot of factors we don't know about. For example, subrogation. We don't know how the FAIR Plan is going to assess any overage above its reinsurance program. So until that information is known, I think it's very difficult to make any statement about what the price is. I can speak for ourselves. We'll try and deliver the fairest price, the best risk-adjusted price we can to our clients.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see the 1st of June renewals with the Floridians that don't have exposures to these fires that would probably claim maybe a premium discount. However, we might remind them that the entire market has been subsidizing their losses in the past. So yeah, this is a mutual, and should be probably shared across the entire industry.
I think the pricing, there's a potential for pricing to surprise, maybe even to the downside. I mean, Aditya just gave the numbers. This was a major event in isolation, but not a distress event for the industry. And we kind of mentioned there's some capital on the sideline waiting to get involved, and there's nothing better than a big event, to catalyze that interest materializing into investments. So what I'm most interested in is always capital supply-demand dynamics, because that's essentially what sets price. But we're not an industry in distress, and there is a lot of capital from what we sense on the sideline ready to allocate. So it will be interesting just to see how that dynamic plays out, because all things equal, I think you're absolutely right. Jan 26 will be interesting, but I get the sense there's some people out there that will be pushing kind of opportunistic product, maybe in California, so we'll see if all of that sideline capital materializes into investments, and that could have an impact on price.
And we're also facing now a trade war, right, with the tariffs, so maybe that might push inflation and exposures might increase, and there will be more demand. Obviously, Evelyn, I'm trying to push the price up.
Right. So, up is always better than down.
Suggest. So we only have 10 minutes left, so maybe we'll open up to questions if the audience has any questions. Yeah.
Thanks, Steve. John, so Fairmat Capital. So, Evelyn paints an interesting picture. The way I read the question, your challenge to her, it's like, what do you think about these lower layers? And to me, her answer is almost like, what about them? It's a very committed structural, long-term investment thesis in the more remote layers, right? And it's like, convince me to come down into lower layers. But really, to me, my question is to George, you know, it sounds like a lot of the clients that you advise could become that longer term structural support for the riskier layers, right? I think that's more natural. Can you give me a feel for the size of that market? Like, so for the hedge fund market in general, not just your clients, like what kind of a number would you put on that? Yeah, I don't know what you're going
to
say.
I mean, it's hard to say because the interest is $1 billion. It could be a $50 million that actually materializes, right? So it's hard to say. And I wouldn't say, I actually wouldn't say they're interested in the very riskiest part of the market. Yeah. A lot of that capital is looking at kind of rated balance sheet type solutions, which is much more diversified, kind of mid-risk type exposure. I think the kind of really working layer retro type exposure. You know, our client base is highly institutional and very conservative. Mm. And so, you know, that spread could go out to a 50 no loss return. We've seen some products, you know, these premium reinstatement products, like one shot type co-investment accounts. And that just doesn't resonate with the average board of a US state pension fund or a hedge fund product.
So they're not running down the layer one or anything like that. But is it fair to say that they are willing to be at least just slightly below where the cap on market traditionally operates?
Yeah, I would say that's where the not more sophisticated, but the more ILS aware investor is looking right now. Right. That's where they're shopping.
But what kind of what are the big structural numbers here? Like the hedge fund market is like 2 trillion, 4 trillion. What kind of a number do you put on that?
I have no idea. I can't tell you here.
If you don't mind, I'll put it at 3 just as a placeholder, including private credit, right?
Yeah.
So then,
but that's 3 unlevered, right? So when you lever it and say what's like hedge fund's emotional impact on the market, it's
right. I'm talking equity right here, not actually assets that they hold.
Right.
But then, what percent of that could you see structurally coming over to the ILS market that didn't exist before? Like 1%, 2%?
Yeah, I would say if you, and I'm going to answer the question by just taking the average portfolio, right? Axia doesn't have a model portfolio. We don't have an asset allocation group. We work on a client-by-client basis. In general, if you take your average 12-line item hedge fund portfolio, there may be one line item for ILS, and that can be anywhere up to 5% of that portfolio. And we run portfolios all the way from $50 million to $3.5 billion. So it could, you know, it's very, very client specific. We've never run product or fund of fund or one size fits all. It's all very bespoke. So we might have a client that comes to us and says, hey, we do want to look at that really high risk, lower layer retro stuff. And we might have another client that says, no, we just can't go to our board and show them a down 50 and trap collateral like that. We just can't do that, but we're in the asset class. So I'm kind of hesitating to answer your question of like, how much that pool of capital looks like, because that's not really the way that our business operates. And we don't really know until we engage that conversation what the client's risk appetite is.
It's very particular, right? It's not homogenous, so you have to say that. I get it, but putting words into your mouth, let's say that's 3 trillion, and maybe 1 to 2% of that potentially could become a structural type of allocation. I don't think that, I understand that your market's not like a giant long-term pension funds that don't necessarily hardwire anything.
Right.
But if those numbers are right, then that's like a $30 to $60 billion potential structural support. Not going to happen overnight, et cetera.
I hesitate to, I mean, mathematically you're right, but a lot of the hedge fund capital in the space is not structural, I would argue. And so, yeah, that number might be right, but year over year, it could be a percentage of that. There's a lot of the interest that got sparked in Q4 2022 was not people like myself going out there. It was you had a US state pension fund with an investment in a multi-strategy hedge fund, and in the final paragraph of their annual newsletter they mentioned this small ILS exposure that they invested in. That triggered a lot of reverse inquiry to people like me saying, hold on a second, we have this hedge fund that's in ILS, like, why have we never spoken about that before? Let's have a conversation about that. That's what actually triggered the interest, but I would argue that those hedge funds investing direct, there are a few that are very long-term structural that everyone knows. I mean, they are opportunistic, but there are some that are in just because Ian happened. They're not going to be in for very long. And so we're talking about, like, your average asset owner. I think that number is a lot smaller than your $20 billion multi-strat hedge fund that's in, but probably in for a couple of years. And we've already seen that money start dripping out of the market. So I don't know if that addresses your question directly.
It does. I mean, I think you're clarifying. It's not necessarily going to be a tsunami or a wall of money coming in. But it does sound to me, even with what you're saying, that maybe rather than being, a $40 billion structural support, it's non-zero, though. It feels like that's coming on.
Oh, it's definitely non-zero.
But non-zero could be $10 billion or $20 billion, et cetera, which is, it's baby steps, but...
Me trying to forecast a number is like me trying to forecast the weather. It's just like, it's whatever I think, every year I've been proven incorrect in terms of converting demand into actual checks being written for the asset class. But I totally agree with you. It's definitely non-zero in terms of...
We have 4 minutes left. So, John, if you don't mind, let's ask if there is anyone else that have questions. Otherwise, I'm sure you can corner George later.
Going all the way back.
Just get ready for it, George.
There's one back there, Lorenzo. Lorenzo? Back there.
Steve.
Thank you so much. Yes, it is. I think this question may be directed toward Evelyn, who brought up the point on climate change and how that, as broad and as a book transcendent and event transcendent phenomena it is, how it should be incorporated into pricing going forward. So my question is how do investors see the current effort or lack thereof to quantify the impact of climate change on a per book, per subject business basis? Or a per risk basis, and whether or not that factor exists currently, how should it be loaded onto an EL, or how should it be sold to, or if not sold, then explained to cedents and brokers in order to make that loading or cost more palatable in a meaningful way? Thanks.
That's a very technical question. I don't have the answer to that. I think for me, it's just, I think a lot of investors just make the connection between some of these losses that are happening and climate change. And first of all, what I would like to see is that there is a clear answer. So not everything, in my opinion, is contributed to climate change. So I think there is some education that needs to be I think the industry might know, but I think the investors might know slightly less, that we can improve on that. And then secondly, similar to the wildfires, sometimes it feels like the modeling firms are, as said before, are catching up on recent experience, whereas typically if the world changed 20 years ago, you'll start to see the effect maybe 20, 30 years later. So that's my comment about making sure that this trend that we all see, that we start to incorporate that into the modeling, not just backward looking, but also, and that's then a scientist needing to find a good solution for that, but to start to assess it, forward looking, things we haven't seen yet, and also then the industry to price for that. How that will happen, and if that will happen, not sure. But it sounds, at least for an investor, I think it would help addressing the question that we're on top of climate change.
Thank you. Hi. Mexico and Brazil have emerging ILS markets, local securities starting to be traded there. And when I say emerging, I mean think about the early, like the beginning of the process, right? There's an ecosystem of pension funds, and I think many of the characteristics of the global market are there. And my question to the panel is the industry ready to sort of look at other forms of securities coming into for diversification purposes, for, is the industry mature enough to invest in emerging markets in the types of securities that are traded there and not in the standard form?
Can you repeat the question because it was kind of hard to hear?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Again, Mexico and Brazil. The last part, just wondering if the industry is ready to look at those markets and invest in securities traded locally rather than in the standard form.
Traded locally in and standard.
Evelyn, you're the investor. Why don't you start?
And for me, the answer will be if it's well modeled and it's well priced, then we might be open to look at it. But I think that's already maybe the problem for Mexican and Brazil risks, that I'm not sure whether that is there.
So you're referring to trading over-the-counter these instruments, or you're referring transferring the risk? Because we've already been transferring some of the risk through parametric triggers, right?
Right,
which is
absolutely
usually the solution for developing countries. So there is always an asymmetry of information between the local surveyor that should estimate how much are the losses versus the trust that their insurers would have for the local surveyor. So parametric has been the answer for that. And I think there is a parametric panel later today, which will probably cover this. But in terms of how the market is evolving, obviously there are a number of initiatives as well to improve the liquidity of the market, to put it on listed stock exchange and so on. I guess the devil is in the detail in terms of how they're going to achieve that, because there is also, when you have a loss, it takes time for claims to develop. There is an element of valuation, which is always difficult. And then, to come to Brazil and Mexico, I think first we should do it and for the more developed countries, and then, also go into those areas. Not sure whether we cover it, but yeah.
Okay. Fair enough.
So we still have couple of minutes left, if there is anyone else that has questions. Otherwise, I think we have a break after this, and probably people want to get a coffee. I can ask another question, but it's going to last for sure more than 2 minutes. Any questions? No? Okay. Well, thank you very much, everyone.